It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, October 16th, 2022. I'm Chad Pergram. Another conversation from both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue as the House Select Committee on January 6th subpoenas former President Trump for his role in the Capitol riot.
At this point, has it achieved what it set out to do? And if not, what would have to happen for that sort of to be fulfilled?
I'm Ryan Schmelz. It's one of the most competitive and vital races of the midterms, as Republican J.D. Vance and Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan could be the deciding factor in which party controls the Senate next year. After both candidates met for a contentious debate, who has the edge as we hit the final weeks of this election cycle?
What keeps this close is the fact that Ryan's running a smart campaign and Ohio is not yet ready to be declared a reliable Republican state.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Well, there's two ends to Pennsylvania Avenue. I'm Chad Pergram. I'm on Capitol Hill. At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue on the North Lawn is my colleague Jackie Heinrich. And Jackie, the economy, Saudi Arabia, gas prices, all of these things are kind of meshed together this week. Tell us about that.
Yeah, tough week for the president. And I expect, Chad, that when Congress comes back in recess after the midterms, you're going to be dealing with a lot of these same issues on your end of Pennsylvania Avenue. But long story short, you know, you've had three pretty tough economic readings this week. The producer price index from Wednesday showed that costs manufacturers pay to make goods are rising, meaning there's a good chance that those costs get passed off to consumers, and certainly an indication that inflation has not peaked. That is the biggest challenge for the president in every single poll. That was not a great reading. And then you had the consumer price index Thursday that showed inflation jumped to 8.2% in September compared with the year prior, largely driven by food, housing, and energy costs. And the consumer sentiment index that came out today showed, surprisingly, that people are feeling a little bit better about the economy than was expected. But the raw numbers in the in those two inflation readings are pretty tough. And a lot of this inflation is coming from energy. OPEC's decision to cut back oil production, rebuffing all these requests from the White House, has really sort of put a spotlight on the failure of the Biden administration to convince Saudi Arabia to, stabilize global markets. There's a serious call now from Congress, which I expect you'll be reporting extensively on, for the president and for leaders in Congress to move forward to scale back arms sales to Saudi Arabia. We've had this longstanding agreement where the U.S. will provide them arms to defend the Saudis from enemies in the region, so long as the Saudis supply enough oil to keep global markets stable. Clearly, they did not do that. They've, rebuffed the president's overtures, including a fist bump seen around the world with the Saudi crown prince, which probably cost more in political capital than it was worth, looking back. But it started this whole sort of exchange of really rare public jabs that lifted the veil about what went on in those discussions. Yesterday, the Saudis hit back because over the last few days, the White House, the administration has been, framing this decision from OPEC Plus and the Saudis as a decision to side with Russia. The Saudis hit back and said, well, it had nothing to do with Russia. Now take this for what you will, because this is the Saudis talking here. But they said it had nothing to do with Russia. It was purely economic. And in fact, revealed that the White House had tried to stall this decision for a month, push off this decision until the next calendar day or the next OPEC meeting on the calendar, which would be a month away, and fueling speculation that Biden wanted to push off any bad news until after the midterms. Clearly, that is something that the president's critics have seized on. The administration, you know, does not deny that they asked to hold off on that decision, but they say it had nothing to do with politics. They say that they presented data to show that production cuts were not only not necessary, but would, you know, further harm this global economic recovery that we're going through that's been compounded by COVID and then Russia's war in Ukraine, yada, yada. So that sort of foray of statements between the two sides and then also the U.S., alleging that, you know, the Saudis really drove this decision. We were told yesterday here at the White House that other member states of OPEC Plus had expressed to the administration that they felt that their arms were twisted by the Saudis to get them to, you know, support these production cuts. So this, a really long answer to your very simple question, is going to continue to be a pretty big challenge. You're going to see it probably bubble up at your end of Pennsylvania Avenue when Congress comes back from recess. And in the meantime, you know, the president's stuck with these tough numbers on the economy, stubbornly high gas prices, and now more information to show that his foreign policy and his leadership has not really gotten the results that they would have wanted. So not an ideal place just a week or 4 weeks out from the midterms, but, you know, these are the cards that they've been dealt. But Chad, I know you've been busy this week with January 6th. And to my surprise, we didn't hear anything from President Biden on the hearings.
That's right. Well, you know, we're certainly hearing from former President Trump. And it remains to be seen as to whether or not he would comply with this subpoena that the committee issued. It's pretty rare to do this. It's not unprecedented, but you have to go back to the 1950s when former President Truman was asked to appear before the House Committee on Un-American Activities about the Red Scare. Then you got to go back to the 1840s when you had two former presidents. You had John Quincy Adams and also John Tyler, who were asked to come and testify about clandestine intelligence activities and how they handled it during their administration. So this is pretty rare to even have this, but President Biden has not weighed in on this, as you say. It remains to be seen as to whether the former president would come. There's a lot of bluster coming from him. He sent a very, very meandering 14-page memo to Benny Thompson, the chair of the 1-6 committee, basically, going through all these conspiracy theories about the election. Didn't actually say he would testify. There was one source close to the president that our colleague Brooke Singman alluded to, who said he would love to come and testify. And I talked to Jonathan Turley, the law professor at George Washington Law School, who said that, you know, to hear that the president might actually want to come and testify would put most defense attorneys into his term a fetal position, because with all of the other legal issues that the former president has going on, that's a problem. Now, will this actually happen? And of course, people would say if they were truly serious about getting Donald Trump to come and testify, why not do that at the beginning of these hearings? I mean, you know, technically, the first hearing that they had was in late July last year. You know, they started this series of hearings again in June of this year. And this committee is probably going to expire at the end of this Congress if Democrats lose control of the House. The Republicans, if they're in control, will dissolve this committee. They might want to relitigate other parts of the riot or the security posture here at the Capitol in their own way. But this committee is not going to be constituted this way. So they kind of got to get this done before 11:59 a.m. on January 3rd. That's when this Congress expires. But here are the mechanics, Jackie. What they would do if they're serious about this, and this is where they're starting to run out of track. House is out until the middle of November, but if they don't think that the former president is going to comply, what they would do is they would have a vote on the House floor to hold him in contempt of Congress. You have to go back to an 1857 law that says, yes, Congress can hold you in contempt and compel you to appear or provide documents under a subpoena, which is what the committee issued. And if you don't, then if Congress has voted to hold you in contempt, and remember, this is what happened with Steve Bannon. This is what happened with Mark Meadows. This is what happened with Dan Scavino. They sent these referrals down to the Department of Justice. So Peter Navarro was the other one, the former Trump administration official, worked on trade issues, as you know. And so they've only kind of forged ahead at DOJ with two of these in terms of prosecutions. They're not prosecuting Meadows so far, not Dan Scavino, but they have prosecuted and convicted Steve Bannon. Peter Navarro, jury is still out literally on that case as well, but they are going to prosecute him so far. So whether or not Merrick Garland and the attorney general would take this up is another question. And that could add to all of former President Trump's legal troubles. There's something else that I talked about a little bit the other day, and I've heard about this for years and did a couple of stories about this several years ago. There's something called inherent contempt. Now, this is where Congress, if they don't want to go through the DOJ because they're their own branch of government, you know, first article of the Constitution there, so they can enforce things on their own, where what they used to do in the early 19th century, late 18th century, the earliest days of the Republic, if they felt that you weren't being, weren't complying with something, or there were a couple of newspaper publishers or they didn't like what they were doing, they went and actually arrested, the Congress did, mind you, the sergeants at arms, and brought you to the Capitol and held you. They kind of executed this on their own. And I remember I asked Nancy Pelosi a few years ago about this, and she kind of laughed. She said, well, we have a little jail in the basement of the Capitol that we could keep them. And I kind of truth squatted this because I went down. It's actually the space underneath the crypt here in the Capitol, Jackie.
Where there's
these bars and everything. But they used to
Wasn't
keep.
Wasn't that supposed to be George Washington's tomb?
Well, exactly. And there's no evidence that they've ever kept anybody in there, but it kind of looks like a jail. You know, that's the funny thing. So that's kind of this running joke. The last time they held somebody in inherent contempt, inherent meaning that they have control of this, they don't send this off to the executive branch of Congress, but they hold this on their own, is there was an airmail scandal with the Postal Service back in the 1930s. And there was a Commerce Department official who just would not play ball. And so they went and, quote, arrested him. And Jackie, if only we all could be so lucky, they held him for 10 days at the posh Willard Hotel in downtown Washington, D.C., probably with room service and champagne flutes and everything else. And so not the little dingy, quote, jail, the former Washington, what was supposed to be George Washington's tomb here at the Capitol. So, again, we don't know if that would ever happen. But it does make for just one more thing to talk about, ahead of this very active lame duck session of Congress that's going to start shortly after the midterm elections here in a couple weeks.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you think that, you bring up the committee probably being dissolved if Republicans take back the House, and just looking at the numbers, it looks like they will. Every Democrat's going to be, I'm sorry for them to hear that, but just looking at the data and historically speaking,
tough map, party in power loses.
Yeah, they lose seats. So, assuming that the most likely outcome is that this committee gets dissolved, at this point, has it achieved what it set out to do? And if not, what would have to happen for that sort of to be fulfilled before this committee is dissolved? What's the end goal? Has it happened yet? What would it look like?
One goal of this committee was to kind of establish the record, because, as you know, there was a lot of misinformation out there about the election, propounded, frankly, by the former president and some close to him. And one of the biggest things that have come out in these hearings are people close to him, former counsel, former campaign manager, saying, look, you did not win. There's no route. People like the former Speaker of the House in Arizona saying, we can't just certify this on your behalf, Mr. President, unless you show us some evidence. So, kind of the truth squatting of that was one of the main goals of the committee. Now, if the goal of the committee was to make this into an electoral issue, and this shows up a little bit, and I am holding my, thumb and index finger very close together here, this shows up a little bit in election polling as the future of democracy being an issue that's important to the American voters, okay, a little bit, but there's nobody really running on a campaign like that. So that never resonated with the voters, even if that was their intention. I mean, the members of the committee would say, no, that's not our goal. I mean, I even asked Jamie Raskin, the Maryland Democrat, a couple of weeks ago, member of the committee, I said, is there concern that you might be holding this hearing, this final hearing, too close to the election? This is after they had to punt for about a week and a half because of the hurricane that came through Florida, Ian. And they and let's be frank, even if you're
was that
you're not
an excuse,
cynical,
though?
Well, even if you're not cynical about this, they knew that they were not going to get TV coverage of that hearing. And so
and
there you go. So that's one thing. This is optics. But, so they didn't really resonate in the political sphere. But Liz Cheney has said something consistently. She has said that our goal is to make sure that Donald Trump gets nowhere near the Oval Office ever again. that this was completely disqualified. And if that is the goal of the committee, that remains to be seen. Now, there have been some people ask, are we at the end of the story with January 6th and the Trump presidency? Did that happen? And the riot happened, and now there's the recriminations, and we're still trying to figure out the history and who all got hurt and who all was culpable and everything else. Or are we somewhere in the middle of this story? In other words, people talking about challenges to democracy. I've argued that, you know, this election coming up in 2022 is going to be our first test drive since the riot. And you have a number of people running for office in states and even Congress who are reluctant to accept certain election results, to say nothing of certain voters. And is that what consumes our fall post November 8th? You know, oh, this race wasn't called. Oh, there's a conspiracy about this. That might be the new reality that we're in. And that's something that the committee was trying to dispel, at least in the instance of January 6th. But it appears not to have done anything to address the issue of Americans' concerns and some of these officials, mostly on the Republican side, who are so-called election deniers, Jackie.
Well, let's hope, just for the sake of everyone, that we don't have a major issue like that. It sounds
I want to watch
exhausting.
Football this fall. I want to. I don't want to be in the Capitol every Sunday and Saturday afternoon, and I want to watch football and hockey and do all those fun things that we do in the fall here. But
we
that
give
might
enough
not be
of our
life.
Lives to these jobs. I mean, my God, people could just settle down.
The Capitol is my second home here, and it's and by the way, I keep hearing this. We should tell our listeners what is the noise that we're hearing there on the North Lawn. I know sometimes when I see live shots on our air, and it sounded like they were building. Is this a pipeline they were building there on the North Lawn? What was that all about?
You know, I wish I could give you more specifics, but there's basically there's been construction right outside of the Oval Office for over a month now. And depending on the day, there is either a like vacuum truck or a jackhammer or some sort of a steel grinding operation. They're doing something. We don't know what it is. But it's going on at all hours of the day. And so if you hear that in the background of a live shot or two, we kind of have a running joke that it seems to stop right when we get off TV.
So I don't think they do it. So is something insidious about this? They try to get it on when you're on TV?
Okay. I don't think so, but it just, you know, the coincidence has happened enough times that we're all like, huh. But I can't even see them right now. They're a good distance away. There's one operation that's a whole lot closer to my camera than what they're doing right now. And when that truck comes out, you will hear it. I mean, it's like a freight train in the background. So luckily that's not going on today.
It's funny here at the Capitol. And I know you interned up here many years ago and you used to work with us here on the Hill. So you know your way around the Hill. There was, you have a marble building. Marble corridors and hallways and floors, and they bring these carts through. And there have been places where I've been trying to either A, do an interview or sometimes a live shot or whatever. And again, it's the same thing. And because these corridors, I remember years ago, we were over in the Senate by the Senate elevators. And the prospect is, I hear the truck coming again there, Jackie, is that all of the senators come up, for the most part, this one bank of elevators and go into the Senate chamber to vote. And so all the reporters kind of stand around in this hallway trying to get them. And it would make no difference. You know, you would find whichever senator you were trying to interview that day, and here would come some big cart, some big hand truck, whatever, and rattling around. And this is back when I used to do just radio exclusively, and I would be trying to do radio, and just the loudest noise, and I was with one of my colleagues, and he just started laughing because he said, same thing, it's almost by design. You know, this is when we're trying to get so-and-so or Senator Grassley or whoever it is.
Let me give you an example of just how you know, impressive their timing is. So you know that big vacuum truck I talked about and said it wasn't here? Guess what's pulling up right now?
The vacuum truck.
Yeah, the McVac. So anyway,
as they say, nothing exists in a vacuum, right, Jackie? So
no, very nothing good. Except for the Situation Room, and they're trying to pump something out of there, it seems like, because that's approximately where this truck is located. It's right, you know, next to the Oval Office, and it looks like they're sucking something out of the ground. Anyway,
I will lead our listeners to divine into that what they think is really going on there. So, So, well, Jackie, good to talk with you on one end of Pennsylvania Avenue at the Capitol. I'm Chad Pergram, and Jackie Heinrich, my colleague, on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue on the North Lawn with the vacuum truck.
The noisy end. Thanks for listening.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
The importance of Ohio for the 2022 midterm should come as no surprise, as up until then, President Trump won the state in 2020. The last time a candidate won Ohio and lost the presidential election was 1960. This time, Ohio could determine if Republicans can take back the Senate, as the polls are nearly deadlocked between Republican J.D. Vance and Democrat Tim Ryan. Vance is a Marine Corps veteran, venture capitalist, lawyer, and author of the book-turned-Hollywood movie Hillbilly Elegy. He campaigned as a political outsider who's closely aligned with former President Trump. Ryan, on the other hand, has served in Congress for almost 20 years, representing Ohio's Mahoning Valley, an area that was hit hard when the United States went through a decline in steel and other manufacturing industries.
The primary rules that, you know, may have been in play in elections past really don't count much now.
Brian Calfano is professor of political science and journalism and the interim head of journalism at the University of Cincinnati. He follows Ohio politics closely.
I know Vance, of course, spent money and had to deal with all kinds of attacks from Josh Mandel and others. But in the end, to have that kind of momentum of winning or from winning that kind of contested race, it actually serves, in Vance's case at least, to springboard him in terms of publicity. And this is the sort of problem we'll talk about with Nan Whaley in a little bit in the Ohio governor's race. Vance had name recognition to a certain extent because of his book, and, you know, he was around a bit in different circles because of his job. But in the end, the question about Vance was, is he going to be able to walk back his criticism of Donald Trump in 2016? And you almost wanted to have that kind of spotlight in the GOP primary because once and for all, I think it helped launch the eventual winner, in this case, Vance, into a position of being Trump's chosen candidate, Trump's guy. And if you had less of a conflict in that primary, you probably would have had less media interest in it and less public interest in it, which means Vance would have had to spend money anyway to get his name out across the state and to make it known for folks that Donald Trump has given Vance and the Vance campaign his blessing. You got to spend money either way. Either you spend it in a primary or you're going to spend it in the general election. The free publicity, though, from that kind of conflict that we saw in the Republican primary in Ohio earlier this year, actually, in my estimation, plays to Vance's advantage in the general election.
Now, speaking of money, there's been reporting out that talking about Tim Ryan's lack of money that he has and how he's really struggled with fundraising, yet this race is still very close. Obviously, J.D. Vance had to recover from the primary in terms of fundraising. But what, in your estimation, is it just fundraising, or are there other factors at play to why this race is so close right now?
Well, I think part of it is that Ohio still has not shaken off its purple shade, if you will. I know over the last couple of presidential cycles, the conventional wisdom has been, well, the Ohio electorate is now red, you know, dark red or deep red, whatever you want to say, because of former President Trump's success in 2016 and 2020. But going back to 2012, you have a vote for Obama. And I think it takes a lot longer than just a couple of election cycles for an entire state electorate to move reliably to one side or the other. And when you have someone like Tim Ryan, who has had decades of experience in public office and campaigning, and is running a smart campaign, probably the smartest campaign you can run as a Democrat in 2022, given all that's going on with the economy and world affairs, I think it keeps it close in the end. He's not able to advance, I should say. He's not able to pigeonhole Ryan as being, you know, a tax and spend liberal or a socialist or all the sorts of things that you'd want to be able to do if you're a Republican going up against a Democrat who usually takes positions that are going to be, you know, supporting what was the Green New Deal. And maybe if you're from the Clinton era as a Democrat, you supported the kind of open trade agreements that a lot of folks in the industrial part of the state really have found to be the worst thing ever for their jobs and their livelihoods, because it's just been a complete disaster when it comes to their ability to have manufacturing jobs and a strong manufacturing base in various parts of the Midwest. So I think in the end, what keeps this close is the fact that Ryan's running a smart campaign and Ohio is not yet ready to be declared a reliable Republican state, at least when it comes to having candidates on the ballot with names different from Donald Trump and Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton. Now, in terms of where this all goes, though, polling is unreliable. I know I say that when, you know, we're working for companies that are spending lots of money on these polls and they want to tout them and give folks a snapshot of how it looks like things are shaping up. But when it comes to reliable polling nowadays, it's almost impossible to do because you have large swaths of the electorate who just don't answer their phone if they don't recognize what the number is. And how many times do you look at your smartphone and you go, I don't know what this, it's an unlabeled number or it's, you know, unregistered, I don't know, it's not on my contact list, I'm not gonna pick up. Well, that could be a pollster. And if the pollster keeps trying, you keep ignoring, then they have to move on to somebody else on their list. National polling, even state polling, with 2% and 3% response rates, even if it's a random sample, and they all are, you're going to end up having systematic bias in missing certain types of voters. And what we know about the polls in the last two election cycles is that they've underperformed when it comes to gauging Republican turnout and vote. And that's especially the case in Ohio. In 2020, you had Biden and Trump in a dead heat, statistically speaking, and Trump ends up winning by 8 points. So I think in the end, while the polls suggest a close race, this may not be as close as some are thinking, because you're still talking about a national referendum on the performance of the Biden administration and the congressional Democrats over the last couple of years, and the performance economically, at least, has not been good.
Like you mentioned, Trump ended up winning by 8 points. Granted that most of the polls in 2020 in Ohio were either deadlocked or had Trump up by a couple points, and he ended up greatly outperforming those polls. Now, does that bode well for Vance, considering the fact that it was significantly more skewed towards a Republican compared to what the polls were saying?
It should. But the wild card in all of this is Donald Trump's not on the ballot. So we don't know. But I think if the idea and the conventional wisdom, which is sometimes right, which is why it's conventional wisdom, it's not always the wrong thing to believe in. Conventional wisdom says, look, over the last 100 or so years, you've had two examples where the party in power in the president's first term actually gained seats in congressional midterms. And the last time this happened was 20 years ago. So you got to go back to 2002 during the height of concern over terrorism and George W. Bush doing a masterful job of making that midterm a referendum on keeping the homeland safe. Before that, you got to go back to Franklin Roosevelt's first midterm in 1934, find an example of where the party in power in the first term of the president doesn't lose seats. And so the trend here generally is for, in this case, the Democrats, to lose seats, to lose the House and to maybe lose the Senate. Then you layer on top all that's been happening with inflation at 40-year highs and a lot of confusion over how in the world we're going to move those inflation percentages down, unease about what's going on with Ukraine and Putin talking about firing off nukes. Generally speaking, that would not bode well for the party in power. Where you may end up having some degree of improvement for the Democrats is the fact that the Supreme Court came down with this decision to overturn Roe v. Wade over the summer, and that may galvanize certain parts of the electorate that really are not known to be turning out too much for Democrats, at least reliably speaking. So that throws a lot of uncertainty into the air here. But to your original question about helping Vance, I think the wind is at the Republicans' back, simply because of history and because of the lack of good performance on the part of the Biden administration economically.
And as you mentioned with abortion, these two candidates just had a debate that was a very big talking point during that debate.
But Tim Ryan really seemed to try to paint Vance as a Trump loyalist, whereas Vance tried to paint Tim Ryan as a typical liberal. Now, what were your thoughts on the debate, and who do you think any of them came out of as a winner in this case?
Winner in the sense that I don't think either of them lost support among those going in who were thinking they were going to support one or the other. And so I guess that's a win these days, because a lot of these elections, I mean, even if Vance ends up doing better than the polls suggest, the election's still going to be fairly close by historical standards. So neither of them got, I think, to the point where they were in so much trouble they started to lose voters. I think what you're seeing now with these elections is it's really a matter of motivating people on either side to turn out, and whoever wins that motivation race ends up winning the election. Overall, you had solid performances by both candidates, so there weren't the kind of knockout moments that a lot of times candidates are embarrassed by and those sorts of things. So I don't know that there was much in terms of people making new decisions or coming to new conclusions about changing their support for one or the other based on that debate the other day.
And how much do you think these debates actually matter when it comes to statewide races like this? Obviously, we've seen them have a huge impact in presidential races, whether it's the primary or general, but do they matter as much on the state level?
You know, if you're scratching your head and saying, what's the point of this? I think that's a good place to start as someone with, you know, a brain, and most people do have brains and they're functioning. Why would you want to pay much attention to a debate where two guys are running for the Senate and they're claiming they're going to do X, Y, and Z when they get into office? Because they're not running for the presidency. So it's almost like, you know, you're trying to gauge in these debates how ideologically consistent or pure a particular candidate is when it comes to different issues, and then gauge from that how they might behave when they're in Congress, which is a whole different type of service style than being in the executive branch. Because in the executive branch, by definition, you can make decisions unilaterally. When you're part of Congress, you're having to work within your party. Maybe you're working across the aisle. Maybe you're working across with the other chamber. But for the most part, you're having to find a way to go along. And sometimes that means going back on some campaign promises. So when you have this litany of things that folks say in these debates, and if you have folks at home watching and hanging on every word, I think that's a mistake. The debates in that sense really aren't that helpful, because for the most part, for better or worse, the legislative agenda is actually set more by the president these days than by Congress. So what either of these guys are going to end up doing in the Senate is going to depend on what Biden decides he wants to try to do and who ends up winning that chamber. And neither of those are points that you can actually know heading into a debate and listening to all the talking points they go through during those kinds of sessions.
All right, so now we can transition over to the governor's race. Now, this has been a totally different story compared to the Senate race. We have an incumbent here, Mike DeWine, who's facing off against Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. And DeWine has faced impeachment from his own party due to his COVID policies, and then faced criticism from Democrats for not being, well, maybe not being strict enough on COVID, as well as some other scandals, including the House Bill 6 scandal, which involved First Energy and also led to the downfall of the Republican Speaker of the House. Now, polling has showed DeWine in many cases double-digit leads here. And is it because Ohio is trending red in recent election cycles, or has DeWine done something here that we need to note?
Well, again, we talked earlier about Ohio trending in a particular direction, so that probably helps DeWine. But what's DeWine done to help himself for this reelection? He's been in office on and off for the last half century, just about. You build that kind of political brand in the same state, you're going to have a lot of built-in advantages. I mean, it's like the incumbency advantage on steroids. Mike DeWine is an institution, a political institution in the state of Ohio, whether you like him or not. And to all the scandals that you mentioned, you didn't have a situation where there was a clear link between something DeWine did and illegality. Now, unpopular decisions, decisions that cost taxpayers, all those sorts of things. I think in the grand scheme of things, voters are kind of accepting of the fact that politicians are just going to do things that you wouldn't want them to end up doing, but they do anyway. It's the nature of the business. It's not going to affect people voting for or against the particular candidate unless there's a direct proof provided of corruption or some other kind of malfeasance. And the other thing about this is, and nobody really wants to say this because it sounds impolite to say, but it's hard for a woman to run in this kind of a race. You have all kinds of academic research out there suggesting that women candidates are disadvantaged in many elections anyway. Here you have someone in Nan Whaley who has executive experience in running the city of Dayton and now wants to transition to Columbus for that, but is running up against potential stereotypes that women aren't the best leaders and all those kinds of things out there in the air. People never want to admit to that sort of thing. They're not going to admit to it in a poll, but you have years and years of those kinds of gender stereotypes out there that would be weighing down any candidate who happens to be a woman. And Nan Whaley, for all her qualities, is having a really hard time pushing back, I think, on that sort of, we call it the glass ceiling or whatever you want to refer to it as. It's difficult for a candidate in her position to do well in this kind of a situation when you have an incumbent like DeWine who has just held almost every office imaginable and doesn't have much in the way of scandal sticking to him. He's got a Teflon quality to him that no matter how strident Nan Whaley is with claiming this is the most corrupt state house in the country and all the things that she points out, and people may agree on some of those points, even if they're voting for DeWine, there's just this benign quality about the guy and the sense that Ohio's known of him and his family for decades. It's his last lap, and other things equal, in an election year that's going to be really tough for Democrats anyway. Why not just stick with the guy who's comfortable and we already know him? And I don't really know much about this other candidate, but she's making a lot of claims and statements, and I don't really like that kind of thing. So I think all of those kinds of perceptions that I just mentioned are getting mixed together and trying to account for the fact that she's down by double digits.
And is it also not helped that they haven't had a chance to debate in this race?
Now, that is another kettle of fish. I know that the DeWine side say, well, you know, we debate, we talk, you know, and that not having debates is like having debates sort of thing, which is, it's kind of a fun way to look at it. It would only benefit Whaley if she's able to land kind of a knockout blow. I don't know that in a debate you're going to end up changing perceptions that much of a guy who's been around as long as DeWine. The debates would be more useful for her to effectively define herself to a larger group of Ohio voters, and that's one of the disadvantages of being a mayor, even in a major city like Dayton. You're just not known well enough to eastern Ohio and other parts of the state where you're going to have a lot of support for the Republicans anyway. And so it would work well for her. It wouldn't necessarily work well for him. And in terms of changing enough minds, DeWine's capable enough as a debater. He wouldn't just be up there as a wallflower. I think in the end, you're missing an opportunity as the public to learn about the candidates side by side. But because the candidates can essentially answer these questions however they want to, it's not as if you're able to give them some kind of truth serum and have them answer in a more forthcoming way, no matter how good the moderator is. So I don't know that we really would gain much by actually having debates. The public should demand them and should want them, yes. But in any kind of practical sense, I think we're going to get the campaign we get. And that's just the nature of the beast until the incumbent, in this case, DeWine, starts to feel pressure that he needs to debate. And I just don't see that happening in the last couple weeks of this campaign.
Brian Calfano, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That'll do it for this week's Fox News Rundown from Washington. Next week, we continue to follow the January 6th committee's subpoena of former President Donald Trump, and we'll take a look at more of the key midterm races taking place this November. I'm Ryan Schmelz. This has been the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, in these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.